أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat. It is a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be able to experience this last day of our stay in Dallas as the day of the birth or the anniversary of the birth of our beloved second Imam, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Ruhi Fida, Salla ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. It truly is an additional blessing in the month of Ramadan. The day of the birth of As-Sibt al-Akbar, the first grandson of the Holy Prophet, a day that I'm sure the Holy Prophet Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayhim ajma'een, are feeling truly blessed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to receive this gift. The oldest of the sons of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the first of Sayyidi Shabab Ahl al-Jannah, the two masters of the youth of paradise. It is truly a very joyful, a very blessed occasion, and I hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, due to this blessed occasion of blessing the world, all of us, all the believers, all the people of the world, with this truly blessed creation of His that He has led us through. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this day, we hope that He blesses us especially, and that we are considered somewhat of the followers of Imam al-Mujtaba salamullah alayhi. I was reading one of the du'as, one of the ziyarat of Imam al-Husayn salamullah alayhi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. You know what the rule is, you either don't recite salawat, or if you do it right. Let's have a loud salawat. Muhammad. I got jealous when I read this. It's a beautiful ziyarah. It says to the companions of Imam al-Husayn, it says, you are not only the companions of Imam al-Husayn, you are the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, you're the companions of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, you're the companions of Imam al-Mujtaba. The reason why I get really jealous of that is when you read that history of Imam al-Mujtaba, one thing that you really, really feel terrible about is the loneliness of Imam al-Mujtaba. Okay. And to be referred to as someone, as a companion, a soldier of that Imam, it really feels like a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and I hope that we earn such a title, inshallah. This blessed Imam, I want to say a few words, at the very least. I wish we could have spent a little more time on that. But as you will see, the topic that we've been discussing these last few nights is very related to our beloved Imam, Imam al-Mujtaba. The first thing about our Imam, a couple of points to learn from. We don't want to only talk about the history of the Ahlul Bayt, where it's a story that brings joy to our hearts but doesn't have any practical implication. And we want to take something that we can apply to our lives, something to learn. This concept of مخلصين له الدين, everything from within turning towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and everything else being secondary, and having that very sincere approach towards everything in their lives to be for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is very, very visible in the lives of all of the ma'sumin, but especially Imam al-Mujtaba. I want to give a couple of examples. Imam al-Mujtaba lived for only, unfortunately, 47 years only. Okay, this noble and beloved Imam lived for only 47 years. Out of the 47 years, 20 years, 20 times this noble Imam walked from Medina to Mecca for Hajj. Okay. 20 times. For the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Some of us, when we go to Hajj, we can't even picture the idea of walking from Mecca to Mina. Okay. When you're going from Arafat to Mash'ar, okay, people don't want to do that. They take buses. They can't walk. Imam al-Mujtaba walks from Medina all the way to Mecca to say Labbaik Allahumma Labbaik. Okay. In one of those times that the Imam was doing this, they say his feet were swollen. Some of the companions told him, you know, your feet are swollen, you should... Imam said, no. This is for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is joyful. This is really something for us to learn. Okay. We shouldn't be escaping. أفضل الأعمال أحمزها. If it's more difficult, then it's more rewarding. Then the Ahlul Bayt feel in that moment, reminds you of Imam al-Husayn, right? After seeing all of his companions get killed in the way of Allah, seeing that sacrifice for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and his moments are coming nearer and nearer, you see the face of the Imam glowing. He has a joy that this is for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, Imam al-Mujtaba is displaying the same thing. This is one instance of it. Another instance of the Imam is something that has given him the title of Kareem Ahlul Bayt. All right, we have a Kareem of the Ahlul Bayt, and we have a Kareemah of the Ahlul Bayt. Kareemah Ahlul Bayt is in the holy city of Qum, Fatima al-Mahsuma salamullah alayha. But the Kareem of the Ahlul Bayt is Imam al-Mujtaba. Okay. He's the generous one. He is the one that even those who disrespected him, he showed kindness to them. On three occasions, at the very least, Imam al-Mujtaba has split everything that he had into half with the poor. Okay. He's that generous. The generosity of Imam al-Mujtaba. As a child, he's in that story, that Surat Al-Insan, Al-Dahr, that talks about يُوفُونَ بِالنَّذْرِ وَيَخَافُونَ يَوْمًا. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the Ahlul Bayt. They fulfilled their nadr. Amir al-Mu'mineen and the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, fasted for 3 days. Every one of those nights they gave what they had. Imam al-Mujtaba is part of that. They also gave what they had. As a child, he has that generosity. As a child, he's giving in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But when he grew older, 3 times in his life, he has split everything that he had had and shared it with the poor. Something that we have to learn from. He used to have... And I don't know why people misunderstand this. I've heard people saying that, oh, look at Imam al-Mujtaba. It's okay to live somewhat of a luxurious life. Say he had a lot of food on his table because he invited lots of people. That's completely misunderstood. He didn't used to have feasts that were for himself. These were for people, the poor. Let them come. If you want to have food like that in abundance, loads of it, great. Open the doors, invite everybody in, all the homeless that you can find. That's great. That's following the example of Imam al-Mujtaba. Not to say that, oh, he had a lot of food, let's have a lot of food as well. But we're busting and he went to sleep while he was hungry. Okay, he had this food for others, for the believers, for the poor, those who didn't have. But the best example of that sacrifice for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that showing that ikhlas for Allah, mukhlisina lahu ad-din, not wanting anything for himself, being willing to sacrifice everything. We talked about it in Arba'in. I don't know if it really seeped in. Just remembering those thoughts, what Imam al-Mujtaba did at that moment, and those 10 years of his imamah, the truce that he accepted and he signed, that was truly sacrificing everything he had for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If we understand it. When you look at Imam al-Husayn, let's just look at that and compare these two examples. If Imam al-Husayn was brutally killed in Karbala, Imam al-Husayn had 72 companions that did whatever he said. Didn't question Imam al-Husayn. When he said, I want to pray, they stood in front of him, took those arrows with their bodies, okay, with their hands and their chests and their stomachs, whatever. If that shield could not protect, they wouldn't try to hide from that spear or that arrow coming. They took it with their bodies. Okay. He had 72 of these companions. He had Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas with him. He had Ali al-Akbar with him. He had Zuhair with him, that left everything and came with Imam al-Husayn. He had these people that were there for him to the end. And they gave whatever they had. Imam al-Mujtaba, by his own companions, was being questioned because of this truce. He saved their lives with this. They destroyed his image because of that. People looked down upon him, thinking that he is afraid of war and battle. His own companions, he sacrificed that image. Instead of going and getting himself and Imam al-Husayn and everybody else killed, he allowed his own image to be destroyed for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He gave that away. That's sometimes even more important than your life. Sometimes you feel like, what's the value of a life that no one respects you? Can you just imagine that? Nobody respects you. Everybody looks down upon you. If you're in that situation, truly, death would feel a lot more pleasing than this type of life. Imam al-Husayn, Imam al-Mujtaba, Imam Hassan, salamullah alayhi, took that for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is mukhlasin lahu ad-din. Everything is given. Everything is given for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is something to learn from the Imam. But another thing in that story that is very related to the discussions that we've been having is to look at the people and why this happened. See, the movement of Amir al-Mu'mineen that was handed over to Imam al-Mujtaba, it started at a point where the people came to the door of Amir al-Mu'mineen. They begged him that, we want you to lead us. Amir al-Mu'mineen says in Nahj al-Balagha, we have this, that I was fearful of the lives of Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn, that they're going to be killed. There's so many people there, it's so packed with people, and they're so forceful and pushing. And I was afraid that they're going to be trampled over by the people. They came and they begged. They said, "We want you to come. If you don't come, we will use our swords against you." They were dead serious. They wanted Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi to lead them. They fought the first battle, they fought the second battle, Siffin, a difficult battle. They fought these battles with Amir al-Mu'mineen. And had they continued behind that leadership that they had, had these people, these believers, followed through, when Amir al-Mu'mineen in the battle of Siffin told them, "Look, Malik is winning this battle, he's over there, just a few more strikes of the sword, Muawiyah is gone." If they would have listened to that leadership, if they would have trusted that leadership, what happened to Imam al-Mujtaba would not have happened. Okay. This is also something for us to learn. What we've been talking about with regards to the Hawza, understanding how this establishment that was created by the Ma'sumin, it wasn't something that was created by others, no. The Imams created this institution that we refer to today as the Hawza. Okay. That produces the ulama. This is the creation of the Ahlul Bayt. Imam As-Sadiq salamullah alayh says, "I wish I could be using the whip on my believers liyatafaqqahu." This is the type of spirit that the Imams had to create this spirit amongst their companions, to follow through, study hard, read those ahadith, come ask questions, discuss amongst themselves, develop those opinions, and hand it over, train students, and they multiplied, and you have the houses that you have. This is the doing of the Imam. The Imams have told us, the Imam of our time, Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif, in that tawqi', the writing that Al-Kulayni tells us about, he says, "I wrote a letter to the Imam, and there were a number of questions that he had asked. In response to one of the questions, the Imam says this," the Imam of our time, inshallah, we have the tawfiq to one day laying our gaze upon that Imam, inshallah, as we are deprived currently of seeing and hearing our Imam and hearing his instructions. And hopefully we're longing for, we feel the emptiness within us that we need the presence of that Imam. This Imam, before going into the major occultation, Al-Ghaybatul Kubra, wrote this line for this companion of his, Al-Kulayni, saying, وَأَمَّا الْحَوَادِثُ الْوَاقِعَةِ فَارْجِعُوا فِيهَا إِلَىٰ رُوَاتِ حَدِيثِنَا فَإِنَّهُمْ حُجَّتِي عَلَيْكُمْ وَأَنَا حُجَّةُ اللَّهِ. When things happen, in the events that will be unfolding after I leave you all, refer to رُوَاتِ حَدِيثِنَا. Refer to those that we have trained, these pious ulama. Refer to them. You need to have that strong bond. And the enemy wants to destroy this bond, weaken this bond, by using those questions that we talked about. And therefore, this is truly understanding and learning from the lesson of Imam al-Mujtaba, how they were able to separate between the masses and the leadership, separate between or create distrust between Imam al-Mujtaba, Amir al-Mu'mineen, and the masses, making the masses question that leadership and stop trusting that leadership. This is what's happening. The Imams were able to, from Imam al-Sajjad onwards until the Imam of our time during the minor occultation, they created distrust between the believers and the pious ulama. But it's something that all of the enemies of Islam have always wished to try to destroy. So we talked about how the Ahlul Bayt created this institution. And we talked about the elements, the knowledge that was given, how they gave that knowledge, how they built that up. The element of taqwa, which is extremely important, and it's truly a miracle that the Ahlul Bayt created an institution that although the people within it are not born ma'soom, they're not given that ismah at birth, but they develop a spirit of taqwa that in the most difficult circumstances, when Shaheed Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr is being tortured in prison, when Ayatollah Khamenei, Ayatollah Behishti, all these different ulama were being tortured in prison to try to change course, to the disadvantage of the people, to be bribed to do things like that, instead of saving themselves and harming the people and the masses, the Ahlul Bayt created these ulama so that they continue this path. But we have to keep that bond together. So we talked about what the Ahlul Bayt did, and we started talking about some of the points we need to realize about the Hawza today. One was very importantly understanding the continuity of the training of the Ahlul Bayt. I think we explained a little bit, but let me mention this point. We have this concept of ijaza. There are writings that we have, the ulama have even today. What it tells us, it shows that continuity, all right? That from today, the ulama that you have right now, whether they are in Qum or in Najaf or in Isfahan or in Mashhad or in Kadhimiyya or wherever else that you have these connected houses, that connection is important. You have ulama in these cities that I mentioned, in some other cities as well, that have that connection between them all the way until the ma'sumin. In the books that some of the companions used to compile, they were referred to as fihrist. Sheikh At-Tusi has one, An-Najashi has one, and they go over their connection between them and the Imam. Okay, how, who their teachers were, and who their teachers' teachers were, all the way until Zurara ibn Ayan, for example. Then we have Sahib al-Ghunya, Ibn Zuhra. These are Sadat Bani Zuhra from the city of Halab, okay, in Syria today, that we hope by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we see the believers that are being massacred, unfortunately, by the proxies of this establishment that we have here, the takfiris, the khawarij of the time. They're truly being killed in a very, very brutal way, very inhuman way. We hope that that comes to an end when we have the believers relieved of this difficulty that they're in. Bani Zuhra have these ijazat. It's interesting to read their connection. They're in the 6th century, or maybe 5th, now doubtful if it's the 5th or 6th, but the connection, it's about over 100 years after Sheikh At-Tusi. His line and where he gets his ahadith and his connection to Sheikh At-Tusi, and then from there to the rest of the companions, all the way until the Imams. You have Sheikh Hur Al-Amali, one of the great ulama that we have had in the 11th and 12th century. This great scholar who is buried in Mashhad al-Ridha but comes from Jabal Amil, Lebanon, what we refer to as Lebanon today, in his very great work referred to as Wasa'il al-Shi'a, a book title that maybe you have heard, at least some of you have heard, which is a very, very great compilation of hadith. He's compiled all the previous books into this book called Wasa'ir al-Shia. Recite a salawat, please. At the end of the book, he has a khatima, an ending, and one of those he explains his chain all the way. They refer to them as chain, salsila, from him all the way until Ben al-Zuhra, and from there to Shaykh al-Tusi, and from there all the way to the companions of the Imams, which means to the Imams. That continuity is there. Even today, you go to Qom, you go to Najaf, you go to any of these cities, you have these ulama, they have their chain, they have their writings, and it's exactly known who these teachers were all the way to the time of the Ma'sumin. It's important to recognize that this is a connected line of ulama that are trained by the companions of the Ahlul Bayt and the Ahlul Bayt themselves. Okay, this was one point. The second point that we wanted to talk about is the level of scholarship that we have in the house. For a lot of us, it is not known. Okay, what exactly is it that these scholars do in Qum and in Najaf? Right? Sometimes people think that the ulama, maybe I am of this type that I'm about to explain, but they think that ulama really have nothing to do. Okay, sitting down in Qum and in Najaf, relaxed, just waiting for that khums money to come in, and I don't know, God knows what they do with it. They're just wasting it because there's nothing really to do. I mean, we think that, oh, we're engineers, we're doctors, which is a lot of great work that's happening, but what are these guys doing? You know, there's just a few ahkam, and that's... And you can't tell, because of this lack of knowledge of how the system works, what all is studied, what do people go through? Sometimes we have this dilemma. People go to Qom for 1 year, they come back, people tell them, oh, Maulana, you know, can you give us a talk? You know, after 1 year, you don't really get much from the Hausa. If we have learned really anything, maybe a few Arabic words. Dharaba, dharaba, dharabu, dharabat, dharabata, dharabna. That's pretty much, if they've learned, if they've gotten into Arabic, you don't get too much in 1 year in the Hausa, okay? People can't get it in their head that, oh, the person's been in the Hausa for 5 years, oh my God, he must be a great scholar. 5 years is really nothing in Hausa standards. It takes a lot of time because there's a lot of studies to do. These ulama, when they want to become mujtahids, like serious mujtahid, to the extent that they become maraja, and that's only one area of Shi'i scholarship, we're not even familiar with all the rest that's out there. It takes years. Years of studies. Allama Tabatabai used to, according to one of the accounts, it's so unheard of, and so difficult to picture based on our usual lives, that it's, you know, we question, really, is that really true, or is that exaggerated? 18 hours a day studying. Okay. This is besides all the worships that some of these ulama do. 18 hours, 16 hours, 14 hours of studies for all these different years. Because it requires it. All right. We don't understand the level of scholarship that there is out there. One of the reasons may be that we just send a question and we just get a brief response. It's haram, or it's wajib, or it's halal, or a couple of words, and that's it. We don't know all the background research that is required. Recite a salawat, please. We don't see all of that work that goes in it. And then we have some academic out here looking at the same works of those ulama, putting together an article that's just, you know, a few dozen pages maybe, 30, 40 pages, and they use all the big words that they use in academia. And we look at that, we're like, oh my God, you know, this is really something. This guy knows what he's talking about. There's Maraj over there in Qom and Najaf. They don't really know what they're talking about. We have to know some of, at least, the studies that happened, very, very rigorous studies that are taking place to study the religion and develop that tafaqquh fi d-deen. Very, very fundamental questions. And that's why our belief system, our religion, is so strongly founded that you can't really shake it. There is no shying away from any question in the Hawza. Some of the questions that people are afraid to ask, and they're fearful, like, oh, you know, is this really something you can say to a scholar? Is this something to even think about? You just brush it away. No. Some of those questions that if you hear, if you read, you start being shaken to the core. Is this religion really true? Is this really from God? Is this really divine? Is the Quran even something that has been revealed? All these questions are addressed, seriously addressed. One of the questions that's been discussed over and over and over and over, because it's a very important part of our understanding Islam, is how much can you rely on ahadith that are related through these books? We don't shy away from that question. Can you just rely on these ahadith that we have? Just because we have a book in the 21st century that says Imam al-Sadiq said something, salamullah alayhi. Do you trust it? Do you not trust it? If you have 2, 3, 4, 5 different reports and accounts of something, okay, maybe that's a little acceptable. الخبر المستفيد. But what about if it's only one report, one hadith? One companion says, I went to the Imam, I asked him a question, and this is what he said. Can we trust that? Can we not trust it? Pages upon pages, days of studies, still, from over 1,000 years ago up to today, one of the works of Hisham ibn Hakam, may Allah bless his soul, this companion of the 6th and 7th Imam, one of the discussions that he has had in his book, according to what we have about that book, is the discussion of Khabar al-Wahid. If one person says that I heard the Imam, do we trust it or do we not trust it? This is over, I believe, 1200 years old, this discussion. But they're still, they study it, they discuss it, they come up with new conclusions. Is it khabar al-mawthuq bih? Is it khabar al-thiqah? Is it khabar al-wahid at all? Do we go with something else? And there's different views coming out of this because they don't stick to what other scholars have done and say, okay, you know, this has already been discussed. Let's not look into this anymore. Let's just accept what's there. Let's not question it. No, there's constant questioning going on. Constant questioning going on. Every single one of those companions that we want to take their ahadith, serious studies are done as to whether this person is a reliable person or not. Very serious studies are done on this. We don't want to take our religion from an unknown source. Something a bit more fundamental that people think that, oh, you know, this is, do they even think about this in the house? Of course they think about a lot more than what you can even imagine. How do you understand a statement that's 1200 years old? You've lost the context. You don't know what the people were discussing at that time. Why this question came about in the first place? Are the meanings of the word still the same, or did they change over the course of this time? Language changes, doesn't it? There's certain words that had other meanings. Now they've developed other meanings, new meanings. Are we understanding this in the right way, or are we not? Based on what? With regards to the Holy Quran, when was it compiled? Are these words that we have from the Holy Quran that we're told this is the Quran, is this really from God? Or is it not? They don't just take it for granted and say, we're not going to ask this question. It's forbidden to ask this question. No, it's not forbidden to ask any question over there. You're supposed to ask all those questions and try to figure out what the answers are. And if you can't come up with answers, you're like, I'm not going to accept that. This is how Shi'i scholarship is. There is no question that you don't ask and you don't try to find serious answers for. And we've had these different views. Some of the ulama, Sahib al-Ma'alim, the son of Shaheed al-Thani, may Allah bless them both, he believed that only the akhbar, the ahadith that have come through very, very well-known pious people, they are the only ones that are acceptable. They're called as-sahih al-a'la'i. That's the term that they use for them. All right. And he's compiled a book called Muntaqa al-Juman. In this book, he collects the ahadith that he accepts. He says everything else is not acceptable. He doesn't accept a lot of these ahadith, and he doesn't shy away from that. Other ulama say, no, you have the akhbaris. The akhbaris, the ulama that were akhbari, not the akhbaris that you have today. In certain parts of the world now, you have akhbaris today as well. This akhbarism is really nothing but ignorance. Okay, the akhbarism that existed at that other time, at the time of the Safavid dynasty, which many scholars believed in, that they actually had scholarly explanations for their views and why they believed in that. The majority of ulama afterwards don't agree with them. But the point is that these questions are asked. You have one, in a sense, extreme, that they understand that, no, we're supposed to accept every single hadith you have out there. It's all acceptable. You don't listen to what your intellect tells you, what your aql tells you. You can't interpret the verses of the Holy Quran. This is one extreme, the akhbaris. Then you have Muntaqa al-Juman by Sahib Ma'alim, and what he has there is, no, you're actually supposed to be only taking a few of these companions, relatively. A lot less of the ahadith are accepted according to him. These questions are seriously asked, discussed, and whatever the conclusion is, the scholar goes by it. Some of the ulama consider ijma' to be a very, very important part of deriving law. If you have Shaykh al-Tusi, Shaykh al-Mufid, Shaykh al-Saduq, Qadi ibn al-Barraj, Abu Salah al-Halabi, if you have these scholars, which are the scholars that lived around the time of the late 4th and early 5th century, if they all agree on a fatwa, then okay, that's ijma', that's acceptable, we're going to go with that. And they have explanation, not just because they consider them ma'asum or anything, no, not at all. Nobody considers any alim or any of the ulama ma'asum. But they provide an explanation. They say, this is acceptable as proof. To the extent that even if we have a hadith that goes against that ijma', we're going to take the ijma' and not the hadith. Because this ijma' tells us, a brief explanation of what they say. This ijma' tells us that these ulama that have received their teachings from their teachers and their teachers from their teachers all the way to the imam, it's clear to them what the ruling is. Therefore, this hadith is probably taqiyya. This hadith is probably one of those ahadith that the Ahlul Bayt have said, yes, it is true, they did say it, but it's not what they really wanted us to practice. This is taqiyya. And the environment at that time, many times statements that came out were out of taqiyya. Mansur al-Dawaniqi la'anatullah alayh has Imam al-Sadiq on a day of the month of Ramadan, the last day, and he asks Imam al-Sadiq, is today Eid? Mansur al-Dawaniqi is one of the most ruthless of the Khulafa of Ban al-Abbas. Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayh tells him, whatever the word of the Hakim is, okay, referring to Mansur al-Dawan, whatever the Hakim says, that's acceptable. Taqiyya. He said, it is Eid today. And he said, bring the food. Imam al-Sadiq ate. It wasn't Eid. Out of taqiyya, they had to say things. So some ulama consider this ijma' to be very, very important. Other ulama look at that and say, no, actually. We need a lot more than just an agreement to come to that conclusion. It has to be a certain type of ruling that they all agree on, for example. And other conditions they put on it. Some people, like Ayatollah Khoi, may Allah bless his soul, he didn't really pay much attention to this ijma', and he had reason for it. You have those ulama, you have these ulama, they ask all these questions seriously, and they spend loads of time discussing these matters, so that when they say that something is wajib or something is haram, they feel relieved that on the day of judgment, I have done all the effort that I could have. Looked at all of the ahadith. These ulama have looked, Wasa'il al-Shia has 30 volumes. You can't be a weekend mufti, okay? Just picking up this book of hadith and seeing a couple of ahadith and saying, I don't know why these ulama say this. Hadith of Imam al-Sadiq says that. You know hadith of Imam al-Sadiq, and these people who spend years, they've gone through Wasa'il al-Shia back and forth so many times. They haven't seen that hadith that you think you're so wise and you've it's caught your attention. They've seen all of that. The level of scholarship that we have in the Hawza with regards to fiqh, I'm just now explaining just a few points regarding fiqh. It becomes very serious. The ahadith on alcohol, for example, on khamr, wine, is it najis or is it not najis? We have hadith from Imam al-Sadiq that it's not najis. Go ahead, pray with it, even if it's on your clothes. Go ahead, pray with it. Alright? And then we have another hadith from Imam al-Sadiq that says, no, you shouldn't pray with it. They're both reliable. Imam al-Kadhim is asked again later on, and Imam al-Ridha is asked again, and when you read the ahadith, it says that, oh, this was a serious question, there were different opinions on this. The ulama ikhtalafu. Okay, they have different opinions on this. What do you do with this? You go with the ones that say it's najis? You accept? Why? For what reason? We've had different ulama have different views on this. In some of his books, Sheikh al-Saduq looks at all of that and says, it's not. Pages upon pages, this is discussed very extensively. Because they want to make sure when they give you a fatwa, it is based on proof. On the day of judgment, they can say, God, I may have made a mistake, but this is the best I could do. All right. After 40, 50 years of the study, they give you an answer. They say, it seems like al-dhahir annahu wajibun. It is wajib to do something. Then they say, wallahu al-alam. We don't know. God knows. Okay. When you look at the amount of effort that is put, the scholarship that we have in tafsir, it's truly amazing. This book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that ahadith say, God has manifested in this book. We're in the month of Ramadan, the month of the Holy Quran, Rabi'ul Quran. As a reminder, I hope, I'm reminding myself first and foremost, but also all the brothers and sisters to remember to recite the Quran. This book is not a joke, it's a serious book. The concepts, the teachings found in this book are so deep. And then you can get confused in those works as well, in the verses of the hadith. According to the Quran itself, it has muhkam and mutashabih. In Surah Al Imran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that this book has got muhkam and mutashabih. It has clear verses that you cannot misinterpret, and then you have verses that you can interpret many different ways. And those who want to create problem and create fitna, they always go to those verses that can be interpreted in multiple ways, and they try to misinterpret them. Well, things have gotten so bad, brothers and sisters, people are going to the muhkamat and misinterpreting them. Okay, and unfortunately, we're so clueless that we listen to that explanation like, oh, that sounds intellectual. Seriously, it sounds funny, but it's a reality that's going on right now. Okay. Understanding these mutashabihat, understanding even the depths of the muhkamat, the ulama don't just regurgitate whatever the previous generation of scholars have given them. If I were to go over the history of each one of these disciplines, whether it's usul al-fiqh, or fiqh itself, or rajal, or diraya, or tafsir, or philosophy, or irfan, or ilm al-hadith, or ulum al-Qur'an. And over the course of this history, what different opinions have come out of this, we're completely uninformed. This time which is spent for studies is very much needed. You cannot do without that. So it's important to understand, brothers and sisters, don't think that, you know, you have some backwards people sitting there in Qum or Najaf, al-ayadu billah, just repeating what some of the other scholars have said without understanding it. And no, that's not the Shia ulama. That's not the products of the Ahlul Bayt. Okay. But the last point in this discussion that I want to end with is that all of what we mentioned about this institution, which is the product of the work, the intense work of the Ahlul Bayt, with the wise management that they implemented here, and you can see in their work, which is truly amazing. All of this is to explain the importance of this institution as an institution, and the very great ulama that are there, the true pious ulama that you have, but it's not approving whoever comes out of that system with an imam on their head. One of the things you got to be careful with is, and people play on this, because the masses are not very familiar with all of that scholarship and what is studied and how long it takes and so on and so forth. The bigger the amama of the guy is, and the bigger the beard maybe of the person is, and the nicer that amama looks is reason for us, and the nicer they speak is reason for us to say, oh, this guy is an authority. And we got to be very careful with that. Got to be very careful with that. This isn't to approve whoever comes out of the Hawza is going to be the product of what the Ahlul Bayt created. No. If at the time of the Ahlul Bayt you had Ali ibn Abi Hamza al-Bata'ini that the Imam al-Ridha cursed, and we explained yesterday. If you have Muhammad ibn Abi Zainab that we again explained yesterday how they went astray, and the Ahlul Bayt taught the Hawza establishment at the time how to treat this. If you had al-Shalmaghani during the time of the occultation, a friend of Husayn ibn Ruh, a scholar, the Shia went to Husayn ibn Ruh and they said, what are we supposed to do with the books of this Shalmaghani? Our house, our homes are filled with his books. Well, this is not a small guy. He was a serious scholar. If at that time these ulama went against these figures and said, no, this guy is a deviant person, the books that they have published before that turning point when they deviated, you can make use of them. But afterwards, no, you can't trust the source anymore. We've got to be careful. We have got to be very, very, very careful. Because the scary thing is, when the enemy understands that you have this very strong bond between the followers of the Ahlul Bayt and the pious ulama, one of the ways that they try to tackle this, one of the ways to get rid of the problem, the Shi'i problem, by the enemies, is to create phony ulama. That's also something that they're doing, alright? Create scholars with big ammamas and big beards. that are not pious. They look like an alim, but they're not. And it's difficult for this. One of the difficulties of this day and age is that if at that time Imam al-Ridha was easily able to curse openly Ali ibn Abi Hamza al-Bata'ani and Ziyad ibn Marwan al-Qandi and others, if he was openly able to curse and do la'an of Muhammad ibn Abi Zainab, or known as Abu al-Khattab, in this day and age, the ulama can't come out and curse the deviant mu'ammameen. Okay. You have to be wary of this. You have to figure this out. Be conscious of this problem and try to consider that not every person who comes out and speaks in a very forceful and powerful way, in a very entertaining way, is necessarily going to be one of those products of the Ahlul Bayt, one of the students of the Ahlul Bayt. We have a hadith in Al-Kafi that says, was that adhan right or was it just something that went off? Is it adhan time or is it not? Okay. Then I'll leave that for some other time. We hope that we are able to learn from this history of the Ahlul Bayt, learn that we do have trained ulama that we're supposed to have that relay, that strong bond with, and we shouldn't allow the enemy to cut us off, and we do have the false ulama that we're not supposed to be getting connected to. And we shouldn't get confused. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to hasten the return of our imam, to please his heart with us, make us his true companions. بالنبي وآله رحم الله من قرأ الفاتحة مع الصلوات.